Support for IPR comes from Patrick Furry Law, a business law firm offering technology agreements, intellectual property law, privacy law, and more. Proudly supporting quality local journalism. Online at patrickfurrylaw.com.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end this news week. Coming up a little bit later, we'll hear about Governor Reynolds' threatened lawsuit over new Title IX protections. Also, is food assistance for lower-income Americans on the chopping block in the new farm bill? And we'll hear about a Des Moines towing company that stands accused of predatory practices. That's later in the hour. First, though, an update on what's been called the MOMS program. Back in 2022, the Iowa legislative session then, Iowa lawmakers passed a controversial program known as MOMS. It provides state funding for anti-abortion crisis pregnancy centers. With an update, Natalie Krebs joins us now, IPR's health reporter. Hi, Natalie.
Hello, Ben.
This program, as we've talked about before and heard in the news updates you've given us, has had a problematic launch. What's the latest?
Right. So this program was established by the Iowa legislature in 2022, and then it required that the state hire an administrator, a third-party administrator, to basically give out funds and oversee the program. The problem is the state put out two different rounds of requests for proposals. The first time they got a Texas-based organization that had had some controversy down in that state running a similar program was their only bidder, and they declined to offer the contract to that company or to that organization. And the second round, they didn't really have any bids. So basically, they weren't able to find an administrator. So to come this session, lawmakers amended that rule so that HHS can distribute the MOMS program funding themselves. So it's been a little bit of a bumpy start for the MOMS program.
Okay, so this is administered directly by the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services. And remind us, too, before we get into this week's update, a little bit more about the controversy surrounding this program. It's run by religious organizations, not licensed medical centers here.
Right. So the more options for maternal support, or as it's called, MOMS program, basically is, you know, gives funding to centers that, you know, counsel women, but they cannot counsel women for abortion services. So they're basically these anti-abortion crisis pregnancy centers. These centers have been around for quite a while. They're controversial because many of them have services like ultrasounds, pregnancy tests, support for moms, parenting classes, but they're not actual health centers, licensed health centers. And many of them are operated by religious organizations, which kind of brings an ethics question into place, which is, you know, underlying motivations for swaying women away from abortion. And so this state program was controversial because it is going to be giving $2 million of taxpayer funding to these crisis pregnancy centers.
Yeah. Okay. So the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services distributes now, administers this, and is distributing money to crisis pregnancy centers under this MOMS program. What did we learn this week?
So this week, we found out through a records request that the HHS has signed contracts with four crisis pregnancy centers so far: Informed Choice of Iowa, Lutheran Services in Iowa, Bethany Christian Services, and Alternatives Pregnancy Center. So it just means the program's going forward. They actually have contracts. They're starting to give out money. And under these contracts, these two-year contracts, which go through this month through April 2026, the state so far will distribute more than $680,000 to these four pregnancy centers.
Mm-hmm. And also part of this controversy, because we have to not look just at Iowa in isolation, but the national context here. How does what's going on here in Iowa with the MOMS program fit into the national picture and with what's going on in other Republican-led states? Similar things?
Yeah, this is a similar thing. I mean, the idea for the Moms program came from a program that's been operating in Texas for years. The idea of giving state funding to these kind of controversial crisis pregnancy centers has been an issue for a while, and it's something that you see in many Republican states, many states that have a push for anti-abortion, to outlaw abortion. So, you know, this, what's going on in Iowa, you know, with establishing this Moms program and then, you know, putting funding into crisis pregnancy centers is something that's very much echoed in other Republican states across the country.
Yeah. Natalie Krebs, thank you for the update, IPR's health reporter. Take care, Natalie.
Yep. Thank you, Ben.
It's your News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Is food assistance for lower-income Americans on the chopping block in the new farm bill? Well, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, you know it as SNAP, has become a topic in the latest farm bill negotiations. Joining us to explain that, Will Bauer. He's a reporter with St. Louis Public Radio, also a contributor to Harvest Public Media. Hi, Will.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine. So we need to start off with, before we get into SNAP, remind us what the Farm Bill is and what its status is now in the new negotiation.
Yeah, so the Farm Bill is kind of this massive omnibus legislation. And omnibus just means that there's a ton of different things that go into it, right? It's not just one thing. It's this huge encompassing bill that covers agriculture, rural America, food assistance, et cetera, et cetera. And it's passed roughly every 5 years. Now, we're on year six of the 2018 Farm Bill, obviously in 2024, because lawmakers, with everything that was going on with debt ceiling negotiations, Kevin McCarthy losing his job as the House Speaker, so many controversial things, right? The Farm Bill kind of got pushed on the back burner and was extended. It was supposed to expire last year, September 30th, and Congress would have extended it to this September 30th. So right now, the House Ag Committee and the Senate Ag Committee are kind of starting to mull around some ideas and get into the thick of negotiations before it expires here in a couple of months.
Okay, so we have a few weeks, a couple of months, as you just said, in which negotiations will be happening. So we'll definitely follow up on this conversation as this is negotiated and hammered out for the next five-year farm bill. Let's talk about SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. How has that become a hot topic in this round?
So conservative lawmakers have kind of always wanted to put on certain limitations or cut it in various ways. And actually, there was an agreed upon change to the working requirements under SNAP or for eligibility. That was last year during the debt ceiling negotiations. And what Democrats would have agreed to in divided government, there was a lot of Democrats that didn't enjoy that they had to make this compromise, but it was they were raising the work requirement from 50 to 54. So in order to qualify for SNAP, you have to remain working until you're 54 from 50. So that was agreed upon last year, and Democrats felt like they gave up a lot in that. But the agreement kind of under the table was, you know, hey, we made these negotiations, therefore we're not going to change it when we bring up the farm bill next year. But now conservatives are saying, no, we want to make some cuts, so on and so forth. And so over 5 years, they want to make $28 billion in cuts to the SNAP program, right? And that's $28 billion of $250 billion. So, right, some people might say that's just a tiny little bit in this massive program in the Farm Bill. But the Democrats are like, no, hey, we've already made the changes. We've already made the compromises. We're not going to do it. And so they're putting forth, you know, we'd like to keep it where it is. But the Republicans are saying, no, we'd like to bring it back. And so who knows? It's a divided Congress, and there might be more negotiating that needs to happen.
Yeah, right. And for those who do not rely on SNAP benefits, this is a good reminder for those people. This serves a huge part of our population here in the U.S. I looked up, according to the Pew Research Center, in fiscal 2022, nearly 42 million Americans received SNAP benefits. This is over 12% of our entire population. So this is really important, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. There's so many people rely on it, right? It used to be called food stamps until 2008. Probably a lot of people know it as that. But it makes up a gigantic portion of the farm bill. So nutrition programs account for about 80% of farm bill spending. And of that 80%, if you want to think of a pie chart, 95% of that nutrition block is the SNAP program. So to put that into perspective, the 2018 farm bill, SNAP would have totaled or the whole farm bill would have totaled about $430 billion with a B dollars. So this is a gigantic portion of the farm bill.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The other part of this, crop support payments, we have a minute or so left. Tell us, this is the other big part of the massive bill. Any controversial issues there? Is there general agreement there? What's going on?
This is actually an area that Republicans and Democrats actually seem to agree on raising what they call reference prices. And that's basically the price that it would trigger payments to farmers if crop prices get too low. And farmers for a long time have said, hey, we haven't adjusted these over time. They're way too low. Some analysts and economists would say farmers would have to go darn near bankrupt in order to get these payments from the government. Now, there are other economists that say, hey, this program just isn't worth it. Why are we re-upping it, right? They would have to go bankrupt. Farmers would have to go bankrupt in order to use it. So this just isn't worth it. But the Republicans and the Democrats in the House Ag Committee and Senate Ag Committee seem like, hey, no, this is worth it. We'll listen to farmers and we should bump up those reference prices to be a little more modern.
So, Will, in just a few words, in closing, what should we be watching in the coming months as the new farm bill is debated?
Well, I suppose the next thing is that's happening is the House Ag Committee is starting on proposals at the end of this month. The Senate Ag Committee has said they'll wait to see what the House does. And again, Congress is divided, so we'll see what happens.
Okay. Will Bauer of St. Louis Public Radio, a contributor to Harvest Public Media. Will, thanks for the update on the future farm bill now being negotiated.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Coming up after a short break, we'll hear about Governor Reynolds' threatened lawsuit over new Title IX protections. Also, water contamination caused by feedlots here in the state, and a Des Moines towing company accused of predatory practices. That's when we return. It's River to River from IPR News.
Support for IPR comes from Patrick Furry Law, a business law firm offering technology agreements, intellectual property law, privacy law, and more. Proudly supporting quality local journalism. Online at patrickfurrylaw.com.
This December, IPR is heading to the magical Christmas markets in Germany and Austria. Save $400 by signing up before June 11th at ipr.org/travel. Don't wait. Tickets are limited.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Of course, we know water quality in Iowa, a big concern for our state, has been for many years. Iowa has some of the most polluted waterways in the country. More than half of Iowa's tested streams and lakes classified as impaired, according to the state DNR, the Department of Natural Resources' latest report. And as we move into the warmer months with plenty of recreational water activities, it's important to keep that in mind. Our state's water quality, one of the main areas of focus by Jared Strong, senior reporter with Iowa Capital Dispatch. He joins us now. Hi, Jared.
Hey, Ben.
Before we talk a little bit, and it ties together with that impaired water quality report we had from the Iowa DNR, but this week you reported on a small feedlot in northeast Iowa that's likely polluted a creek for years. Tell us about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, the length or the timeline of that pollution is kind of unclear. It's a smaller operation, and it has 650 cattle, which might to most people not seem all that small, but when you compare it to some of the largest, which are on the order of 20,000, it is comparatively small. But for an operation that size, the state does not require it to have a state-approved plan for managing its manure. They don't need permits to start operating, and so they can kind of operate off the radar. And this one apparently has for perhaps decades. The DNR has, in the past decade, sought to identify some of these sites and periodically inspect them, even though they don't have, you know, these required manure management plans. And in this case, an inspection of the site revealed that, you know, for years, likely, manure had been washed off of it by heavy rainfall, and that some of that wound up in a nearby creek.
Mm-hmm. So the operator of this site, identified by the DNR, his name, Ted Fox, what are the consequences for Ted Fox here, and has he at all been trying to keep the manure out of that neighboring stream?
Well, when the DNR made contact with him, he did acknowledge, they said, that that, you know, feedlot runoff was going into the creek, and that he had intended to build some sort of barrier to keep that from happening in the future. This was back in 2019 when they initially discovered the potential contamination. So he was going to enlist the help of federal authorities to, you know, figure out how to construct that. The pandemic happened, and things were put on hold. And it wasn't until the DNR followed up in recent years and found out that nothing that had been done that they acted on that, and recently ordered him to pay $5,000 and to construct some sort of manure control system to prevent further contamination.
Okay, so here we have one case of a small feedlot, small in air quotes, several hundred cattle here in this small feedlot, likely polluting a creek for years, brings to mind the question, of course, Jared, what is your sense of how often this sort of stream pollution goes on undetected until something like this happens? Is this an isolated case? Do you get the sense?
I mean, it's unlikely that it's isolated. I don't think there are really good figures on how many of these sites are operating around the state. Like I said, the DNR is trying to identify them. And even of the facilities where, you know, that they do know exist, that do have these manure management plans, there can be, you know, stream contaminations that, if they aren't reported by somebody, they can go unnoticed for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that latest impaired waters list put out by the DNR back in March. Recap some of the trends we saw there. This is a report that the DNR is required to give out, right?
That's right. Yeah, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency requires it every 2 years. And it's basically asked the DNR to evaluate the state's streams and lakes based on whether they meet appropriate standards for recreation, public water supplies, the protection of aquatic life. And so, you know, more than half of the stream segments, as they call them, there could be multiple segments that they monitor in one river, for instance. More than half of those were found to have to not meet those water quality standards.
Yeah, and I see in the nearly 400 segments deemed healthy by the DNR, some of them meet the water quality standards, but some are put in that healthy category just because there's not enough data, which is not comforting.
Yeah, I mean, there's only so much, you know, that can be done based on the resources that are available. You know, there is a water quality monitoring system that is measuring, for instance, nitrate in real time in various streams and rivers in the state. But, you know, because of manpower and financial and the financial means that are there for it, they can't do it everywhere. The DNR's testing that they do is, and because it's more comprehensive than just looking for nitrate, they'll test those streams once a month rather than having it be in real time. So, you know, they're limited by, you know, the amount of manpower they have and the resources to get it done.
Yeah. Over 700 water body segments in Iowa considered impaired. Only 24 water body segments had proof they met all the quality standards, but that was up from 15 in the last report 2 years ago, you note in your reporting. You also quote an expert that we've had on our program here, David Swertny, director of the Center for Health Effects of Environmental Contamination at the University of Iowa. He said that 24 with proof that they met all standards, so that's an abysmal number, he says. It shows we've got really severe water quality problems. I guess to finish up here, Jared, for those concerned that perhaps a waterway, a stream, or something nearby, concerned that there may be pollution in there, is there anything just everyday citizens can do to know how a neighboring waterway is polluted or not?
Well, I mean, there's information out there online that you can see, again, like with nitrate levels and whatnot, but that doesn't give probably the whole picture. So, I mean, if people see something that is concerning, the DNR implores them to report what they see so they can look into it.
Okay. Jared Strong, senior reporter with Iowa Capital Dispatch. Thank you, Jared.
Thank you, Ben.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Iowa's Attorney General Brenna Byrd filed legal action this week over new Title IX protections. Let's find out more from Caleb McCullough, Des Moines Bureau Chief for the Quad City Times. Hi, Caleb.
Hello, Ben. How are you?
I am doing fine. Let's make sure we're on a firm foundation, understanding what Title IX is, because it's a law that dates way back to the early 1970s. Give us a few details on what's behind this law.
Yeah, so this is a law passed in 1972, and it prohibits sex-based discrimination in education, and so that's at both the K-12 and the higher education level. And this is, you hear about this a lot when it comes to sports at the college level. It requires colleges to spend a roughly equal amount of money on men's and women's sports. It also protects against discrimination at schools based on sex, and has a lot of rules and regulations around sexual harassment in education.
Okay, so let's fast forward to the current time and this, the filing of this lawsuit, Governor Reynolds threatening legal action on Monday, the Attorney General of Iowa actually filing that lawsuit on Tuesday, and this is in reaction to new rules on Title IX put out by the Biden administration. What are the new protections at issue here?
Yeah, so these new rules extend the protections under Title IX to prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation, gender identity, and sex characteristics. So this would be the first time that Title IX is used to protect against gender identity or sexual orientation discrimination. And the administration pointed to and kind of used the reasoning from a Supreme Court decision a few years ago that found that in employment-based discrimination claims, discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity was tantamount to sex-based discrimination. And so they're using that same reasoning to say that the law covers these other types of discrimination.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about the objections from Governor Reynolds and other Republican-led states in the country. I see in your reporting that Governor Reynolds says this is marginalizing girls and women, this expansion. Explain that, the argument there.
Yeah, so Governor Reynolds and many other Republican officials have alleged and for a long time that expanding protections for transgender women and girls, especially when it comes to private sex-separated spaces like bathrooms or athletic teams, threatens the rights of women who or girls who maybe don't want to share those spaces with transgender girls and women. And so that was kind of something that she honed in on, and that Brenna Byrd also honed in on, that this is a privacy concern for them and for some of these students, and that was one of the major issues that they took.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is in conjunction with other states. What other states? Can you name a few? I was right in saying they are chiefly Republican states, or all Republican states, led states by their governments, right?
Yeah, that's right. So there are a few separate lawsuits. The one that Iowa joined is led by Arkansas and Missouri, and it includes Nebraska and North Dakota. Other states that have entered into these lawsuits include Texas, has their own separate lawsuit. I know that Tennessee, Georgia, and a few others have also entered into lawsuits. Kentucky is another one.
Yeah. Just to be clear, and you mentioned the original intent, or one of the intents of the original 1970s law, Title IX, is, you know, women in, that there's no discrimination in sports, spending on sports. I wonder, is this any part of this expansion? Would it impact that? Is that part of this latest controversy?
No. So the Biden administration has proposed a separate rule dealing with athletics, especially when it comes to the participation of transgender girls and women in sports. And so that does not cover this particular rule. So that's been covered by another rule, and that is still going through a review process.
Yeah, you talked a little bit about the laws here enacted by, signed by Governor Reynolds, written and passed by Republican lawmakers in the state. So we had a number of them. Give us a little bit more context about what's been happening in our state in recent legislative sessions concerning gender identity and the transgender community.
Yeah, so this has been sort of a long-running effort from Republicans and Governor Reynolds to, in their words, you know, protect fairness in especially in women's sports. So back in 2022, Governor Reynolds signed a law that banned transgender girls and women in Iowa from competing on the sports teams that correspond with their gender identity. But then that covers both high school and college. So Reynolds and the bill's supporters said that was an issue of fairness. You know, they argued that transgender girls and women have advantages over cisgender girls and women that should be remedied and shouldn't be allowed to compete on the same teams. And that has been done in several other Republican-led states. And then last year, Governor Reynolds signed a law that has also been done in several states that requires at schools, students and staff to use the bathroom that corresponds with their biological sex or their sex assigned at birth. And that, again, was an argument that it's a privacy concern for girls and women in these spaces. But, you know, obviously Iowa's transgender community has said that these laws are an attack on transgender people, that there isn't really much of a problem with, or there isn't a concern with sexual harassment or assault in women's bathrooms, that's not something that is really an issue. And so those things have been very controversial at the State House the last few years. This year, Governor Reynolds proposed a bill that didn't actually pass. It got out of a committee, but never got through the full lawmaking process. And that wasn't directly tied to education, but it would have defined terms like man and woman and male and female in Iowa code to correspond with a person's sex assigned at birth and allow government organizations to give accommodations based on sex rather than gender identity. And that was something that Iowa's transgender community, again, came out in pretty big force and protested at the state capitol, arguing that was going to erase transgender people and, you know, give them less protections under state law.
Caleb, what can you tell us about the timeline for this lawsuit? Of course, we're in the middle of a general election campaign. What will you be watching in the coming weeks with this lawsuit?
Yeah, that's definitely something that the timeline is pretty unclear. Courts, you know, move at a pace that you can never really predict. But, you know, given that there are so many states that have done this in so many different jurisdictions, it's possible that one of these courts will issue an injunction preventing the law from, or the rule from taking effect. It is set to take effect August 1st. So at that time, any school or state that doesn't comply would risk losing federal funding. But if a court does issue a temporary injunction, that would block the rule from taking effect while the lawsuits play out. Those lawsuits could take months or years, so that it could very well spill into election season and into next year if there is a new administration or if President Joe Biden is reelected. So that could definitely change how these things are done. And the rule does, it changes and rescinds a lot of the changes that President Trump enacted when he was president. And so should President Trump be reelected, that could be something that he flips and reverses pretty early on, and then it becomes kind of moot. But yeah, this it could definitely spill into next year.
Mm-hmm. Caleb McCullough, Des Moines Bureau Chief for the Quad City Times. Thanks, Caleb.
Thank you very much.
I'm Ben Kiefer. More after a short break. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
These days, there's an app for everything. Now there's an app for everything you love about Iowa Public Radio. Local newscasts and stories from the voices you trust, your favorite public radio shows and podcasts, plus the music to soundtrack your day. You can have it all in the IPR app. Find it in app stores or at ipr.org/app.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer on this Friday, May 10th. Mark Simmet will be along to groove us out of this news week into the weekend, that in just a moment. You know, groove, of course, is there, well, at least for me, so that we can shake off some of the tension of the work week, of the news week. Speaking of tension, have you ever had your car towed? And I don't mean by choice, not in the case where your car is broken down, you need a tow truck, not that case. The more unpleasant case, even aggravating case, the nasty surprise of finding your car has been towed without your permission. I've been there. I've done that as well. What an awful feeling. Well, this week, Lee Rude, the Reader's watchdog columnist with the Des Moines Register, wrote about a lawsuit in Des Moines that accuses a local towing company of predatory practices. Lee Rude joins me now. Welcome to the program once again. Such a joy to have you on, Lee.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
So tell us about this lawsuit by some Des Moines residents, and do say, what do they mean by predatory practices?
Well, this is actually a civil negligent lawsuit filed on behalf of a woman who was severely injured outside the business office of Crow Tow, a business here in Des Moines that has gained a lot of attention and has been the source of a lot of controversy. This woman was injured 2 years ago very severely when another woman whose car was towed rammed through the front gate, the metal front gate of Crow Tow, when she didn't have the money to get her car out of the Crow Tow lot. And when she rammed this metal gate, the gate flew open and severely injured this woman, and now she's suing for negligence.
Give us the larger picture, because there's a lot of angered residents that you describe in your article, residents about an apartment complex in Des Moines that also has experience with Crow Tow.
Yeah, people have been complaining for at least more than a decade about Crow Tow's practices. And what's interesting about this lawsuit is the attorney on behalf of the plaintiff has done some pretty extraordinary research talking to a lot of former employees of Crow Tow, at workplace safety experts, et cetera. And he's alleging that it is a predatory business. There has been very aggressive towing in different lots around the city, which is what happened recently at an apartment complex that I started my column with over on Hall Avenue. And essentially what these people are saying is that Crow Tow will tow cars, rightly or wrongly, aggressively, sometimes two at a time, several from a lot, charge $200 for the tow, more than $40 each day for service, $150 cash to release the vehicle. The company demands cash. And it also contends that the drivers are paid bonuses for non-consensual tows from private lots, which has been a source of aggravation for a lot of people. But it is, as I write, a very complicated issue. Some businesses and apartment complexes are very pleased with ProTow's services because they help take care of persistent parking problems and abandoned cars and criminal activity when they do these sweeps.
Mm-hmm. You feature in your article one of the people, Joe Ward. He's a 34-year-old mechanic you identify there. And he started a petition, but also before that, he was kicked off the property, this apartment complex property by Des Moines police. Tell us those stories.
Yeah, he's the father of three kids. He has a girlfriend he lives with at the complex, and he was just sort of fed up after four of their vehicles were towed. He started this petition, but at one point he also started to confront tow truck drivers by standing in front of the trucks. It got confrontational, and that got the attention of the property manager, an out-of-state company from Colorado, and he was threatened by police with trespassing, and his girlfriend was threatened with eviction.
Mm-hmm. And he's also he started a petition which thousands of people signed. This goes back a few years, right?
No, actually, his petition is a new petition. He started online and getting people's signatures about 3 years ago or so. There was a lot of controversy about ProTow's practices again. And at that point, I think nearly 7,700 people signed a separate petition urging city leaders in Des Moines to end the police department's contract with ProTow.
And also interesting that you put in there that in as part of this, they criticize city leaders for accepting campaign donations from Crow or his wife?
Yeah, so Randy Crow runs the business with his wife, Dawn Thornton, and both of them over the years have given campaign contributions to city leaders. Last year, which, if you'll recall, was a pretty contentious race for mayor last year and some local races, Dawn Thornton gave about $15,000 to different city council members. And I talked to them for my story. Mayor Connie Bozen told me that she any contributions that she received don't really impact her decision making. And she says that she is going to look at the towing issue in the next few weeks.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you contacted, as part of your reporting, ProTow, the management there. What is their side of the story? What did you most want them to answer?
Well, you know, Randy Crow says that his company is very professional, very transparent, documents everything, claims that his towing service is the best in the Midwest. He points to any number of circumstances where he's, as I said, helped clean up criminal activity. He's stopped people from parking downtown in spaces that people pay to have. He does a lot of private towing at apartment complexes across the city. He says he's been very effective at that. But when I asked him about allegations in this lawsuit of whether he pays bonuses for non-consensual towing, he wouldn't answer that and said it was basically none of my business.
None of your business. And I was surprised to read here, as you mentioned here, Randy Crow started this family business more than 20 years ago, but there's really, and he does say this as part of his defense, that non-consensual towing is you can't avoid it. It's going to be a naturally confrontational business here. And he certainly had plenty of that in the two decades that he's been in business, right?
Yeah. There's been a a lot of complaints to police. In fact, I wanted to check with Des Moines Police, and they said that just in the last year, from May 1st of last year to May 1st this year, police have been at Croteau's offices at 816 Southeast 21st Street 111 times. I checked about a competitor, and police had only been to their office 7 times. But it's important also to remember that every towing service is a little bit different in terms of what kinds of towing they do. So it's difficult sometimes to compare Croteau to other towing services.
Yeah, you point to other states, other big cities with very predatory towing company problems. It reminds me, your writing here reminds me of, well, this is more than 10 years ago. We parked our family minivan outside a store in Dallas, Texas, where later I saw there was, in fact, an almost hidden do not park sign posted. But we were away from our minivan not more than 15 minutes and returned to find it gone, of course. We had to get a ride somehow to the outskirts of Dallas, stand in line with a whole host of absolutely upset people. We were absolutely upset, pay $200. And I have to say, this towing company outside of town, it looked like a penitentiary because they were used to dealing with very upset people trying to pay to get their cars back. And it turns out that this towing company had a real racket on that Dallas city block, so much so that they had, if you can believe this, Lee, tow trucks lined up like taxis at an airport to haul away the next vehicle that parked in this lot very quickly. I couldn't believe my eyes. But of course, you know, you pay your money, you get your car back, and then you never do that again. But compared to other states, there are big problems in other states and other cities, is what I'm driving at. You brought that up in your article.
Definitely places like Chicago have a lot worse problems than we have. They have kind of rogue, unlicensed towing companies that are basically taking cars hostage and demanding, you know, huge sums of money from people who didn't even know where their cars were. So there, the city has had to issue cease and desist orders. Here, the complaint, you know, whether oftentimes when you hear complaints about Croteaus in these lots, people will tell you that they didn't know that that was a Croteau lot. Like maybe they saw signage on one side of a building, but didn't see it on another. And then they're very, very frustrated because they say that there's, you know, aggressive towing taking place. And there's really no wiggle room. You've got to come up with your $200 cash to get your car. And then you have to pay fees on top of that. So it's very expensive for people. And what, you know, some organizations are trying to argue is that this, of course, affects low-income people the most. And a lot of these complexes in town where there's heavy towing affect low-income people who just don't have the money. You know, I talk to people who... like Joe, who had to sell one of the four vehicles that were towed at Aspen Apartments on Hull Avenue, because he just didn't have the money to get them out. And then, of course, if cars sit there for 30 days, they can be auctioned off. A lot of people have complained that their vehicles were stolen and then they didn't find out for quite a while where their cars were. And then Croteau charges them fees anyway to get their vehicles back.
Do check it out, Lee Rood's latest Reader's Watchdog column in the Des Moines Register. Lee helps Iowans get answers and accountability from public officials, the justice system, businesses, nonprofits. We do so enjoy your research and your writing and your work. Lee Rood, thanks.
Thank you so much, Ben.
And that just about does it for this News Buzz edition of River to River from IPR News on this Friday, May 10th. Did you know that on May 10th in 1954, 70 years ago today, Bill Haley released Rock Around the Clock? Of course, it became a classic of the early rock era. And you know, to enjoy the best music, new music, old favorites, doesn't matter, around the clock, all you need to do is check out IPR Studio One. I'm joined now by Mark Simmet of IPR Studio One, one of the hosts, along with Tony Daner and CC Mitchell. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Ben. How you doing?
I'm doing well. We are so ready to have you groove us into the weekend. What do you have?
Well, I've got a couple of songs that we are playing right now on Studio One, new songs. And the first one is from the Portland, Oregon band Blitzen Trapper. They have a new record out, and one of the tracks on it is this one. It's called Cosmic Backseat Education. Cosmic Backseat Education. When you're young, everything that they tell you seems strange. You feel like the ocean in your mind is the cage. You can capture every instant, live your life like it's a stage. In this cosmic backseat education.